You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
What if the future of our food didn't come from the ground at all, but came from the water? From kelp that fights climate change, to oysters that clean entire bays, to salmon raised so responsibly it rivals anything caught in the wild. Today, we're diving into the blue food revolution. Welcome to One Bite is Everything, the podcast that connects the food on your plate to the rest of the world. I'm your host, Dana DePrima, and every week we uncover the hidden links between what we eat and the forces shaping our health, communities, environment, and economy. Today, we are heading into the 71% of the planet most of us never think about when we sit down to eat, our oceans, rivers, and lakes. My guest, Jennifer Bushman, is a leading voice in the blue food movement, working to transform how we source, cook, and protect foods from water. She's behind the Fed by Blue initiative and the acclaimed PBS series, Hope in the Water. In this conversation, you'll discover why responsibly sourced seafood could be a climate solution, how seaweed might rival America's corn crop, and the questions to ask your fishmonger to make sure you're getting the best for your body and the planet. We'll also explore the surprising role aquaculture can play in a sustainable food future and why the choices you make at the seafood counter matter more than you think.
Blue food is all of the foods that come from both freshwater and ocean. A lot of people think of foods from water as mainly being from the ocean, but this is the vegetables, the sea vegetables, the kelps, the seaweed, the fish, and the shellfish. So when we have conversations, it's all of those potential foods that come from our lakes and streams and riverbeds and ponds and the ocean that contribute to over 3.2 billion people's nutrition each and every day on the planet.
When we're talking about being able to produce all of this kind of food, meaning the ocean is doing its part, but we're supplementing it by farming, what does it mean when we're talking about like sustainable ocean production?
Well, I mean, a lot of times people think that the only way you can protect the ocean is if you leave it alone. That if I love the whales, then I have to leave the ocean alone in order for them to have this thriving ecosystem to be in. But the reality is that that ocean, the waters, they make up 71% of our planet. And so just like we can farm chicken well and we can farm chicken badly, we are starting to figure out and build out an ecosystem that really does align with things that people are familiar with, like regenerative agriculture. So this is something that has grown. It's been around for thousands of years. And so when we look at that, it all depends, of course, on which types of foods we're talking about. Kelps and seaweeds, they're extremely regenerative. I mean, they have zero input. When you think about needing to grow a crop on land, you have all kinds of inputs, including water and soil nutrients that you have to contribute to that. But in many, many different regions of the world, in terms of aquaculture, seaweed and kelp is the number one produced from farms worldwide. And there are economies that are built on that. And there are people that are thriving from a nutritional perspective off of having these crops. So we're really looking at as sort of this blue food movement in terms of what are going to be those contributions and starting to really understand what different areas of the food system, from cattle feeds that can actually help contribute to lowering methane emissions from cattle, all the way to really at the end of the day, it's food and being able to make amazing different ingredients out of this. You think about a tomato sauce, all of the umami, all of the delicious salt and the layers of vitamins and minerals that are in kelp could begin to help fill in where land crops maybe will be more stressed. So it's, I mean, if you put 30% kelp into a tomato sauce, you'll never know it's there, but it creates this incredible umami and richness that really helps stretch. What most people think of when it comes to ocean is fish and seafood. And what we know is that we can't continue to have this, what I call consumptive entitlement to wild resources. The ocean and our freshwater are sort of the last wild frontier, and they're 90% fish too, or over capacity.
Many of the world's most commercially valuable species, such as bluefin tuna, cod, and haddock, are at risk of collapse due to overfishing. So what does overfished really mean? It refers to populations that have been depleted beyond sustainable levels, leading to long-term damage to the species and the ecosystem as a whole. Industrial fishing, which includes large-scale operations using massive trawl nets, long lines, and purse seines, is responsible for much of this overfishing. These methods are highly efficient, but they can catch fish far beyond what the ecosystem can replenish. For instance, trawlers often catch indiscriminately, including juvenile fish that haven't had a chance to reproduce, which significantly reduces the fish population over time.
So looking at responsible aquaculture, looking at what technology, better feed models, just like on land, lower densities, you know, these things like free-range chickens and grass-fed cattle, we can do a lot of that by rearing fish and seafood in the right way in our waters. So it is possible, it's happening. And just like how we had commodity agriculture grow in the 70s, move into GMOs, and then we saw this movement where the pendulum swung back, that's exactly the process that we're in right now when it comes to aquaculture.
When people are out, let's just go with seafood, for example, and they go and they're shopping at, you know, their local fishmonger, and there's wild caught fish, and then there's farmed fish. What kind of questions do they need to ask to understand which is better and why? Like, I think that is a very confusing space, and I'm wondering if you have some guidance.
It is confusing. And part of it is that if you think about at the grocery store or on a menu, if it says natural chicken or organic chicken, we all know what that looks like. So it's pretty much just commodity, organic, and natural, right? And so if you were standing in front of that chicken, the poultry section, it would be fairly easy to make a decision. The same is true for beef or pork or lamb. But then when you stand in front of that seafood case, there could be 30 species. You know, there are thousands of species of these blue foods that we actually can choose from. So it's not unlike how you would look to agriculture. You would want to ask where it came from. You wouldn't want to purchase something where you didn't know. You would want to eat as local as possible. And, you know, we were just talking about a local Minnesota farmer that's raising shrimp in this incredibly responsible way. So eating close to the source, but also going to places where you trust. There are certifications, things like the Marine Stewardship Council, Aquaculture Stewardship Council, Best Aquaculture Practices, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. And those certifications, while those, when we look at this 71% water space on the planet, those certifications and recommendations really only touch about 51%. And that would be what would be a poor choice and then what would be a good choice. It's a big blue space. And so we're still not certifying or recommending the majority of the space that's available to us. But there are resources. And of course, going to a trusted source is really important.
So it's really about having a conversation with your fishmonger about where things came from.
Right. The best starting point, and we have this at fedbyblue.org, there's a section called Seafood Scout. And in the Seafood Scout section, we give you the questions to ask. If they can't tell you what country it is, country of origin, and the species itself, you have no starting point. But what I would say is that, and salmon is the one that we eat the most of, salmon and shrimp and tuna, the big three in the US, you would want to understand, for example, if you want to support wild salmon and being able to get salmon out of Bristol Bay, then you want to make sure that you're at a trusted source that's going to get you that salmon. There are salmon farmers, like a third generation family farmer in the Arctic Circle called Quaray Arctic. And that is a phenomenal choice, antibiotic-free, all, again, all of the things that you think of that are so good for a land farm are the same with the farmer on water. They're the number one supplier of Atlantic farm salmon to Whole Foods in the world.
I was speaking with a chef. He works in a seafood restaurant, and he's been very involved with Monterey Bay Aquarium. And he's an avid fisherman, right? And so mm-hmm. he cares very deeply about all of this blue food. And he was explaining to me, and this is something that I did not understand, that in any particular species of fish, this year's, I don't know if this is the right word for it, but this year's class of fish is very strong. But the two or three classes behind it are not. And so there's this sort of interesting chart about the health of a particular species of fish and how it's surviving in the wild, right? And so the headline could be like, striped bass is back. But if you don't look behind, you know, the current class to see, you know, what the next 5 or 6 years look like, you can be misled into having a false understanding about the nature of whether this fish is overfished or not.
The ocean is changing. It may or may not have anything to do with the fishermen. And there are large-scale commercial fishing boats that are doing a terrible job in the ocean space. Terrible. Especially in the deep ocean, which is highly unregulated. But the ocean, things like algae blooms. So when we look at algae blooms, when we look at acidification, when we look at warming temperatures, I mean, look at the Gulf of Maine, these are also causing disruption in the water. And you can have major die-offs from certain species. I mean, we look at the crab die-off that happened in Alaska. You know, we lost over 1 billion crab, and that was very specifically because the temperature did not drop in the water as it was supposed to. And when they do, their appetites go down. And so here they thought there was going to be this unbelievable bumper crop that was of the snow crab that was going to come in the year or two to follow. And they cannibalized themselves because the water did not get cool enough. Their appetites did not drop and they ate one another. And so it is complex. But it is very important that we support eating more fish and seafood, particularly in the United States. Even the worst of choices is still the lowest carbon footprint and the highest nutrients of any food that you can eat. So when we look at when we were really of the sea, we came out of the sea, the need for EPA, DHA, long chain omega-3s, things like psyllium and micronutrients are extremely important to us and will be moving into the future. We're not raising a generation of kids that eat fish and seafood. We have one of the lowest consumptions of fish and seafood for an industrialized nation in the world. We only eat somewhere between 16 and 17 pounds of fish and seafood per person per capita. We eat 35 pounds of avocado. So thinking about how are you introducing this conversation? How are you thinking about this when it comes to chefs? There are complexities, but at the same time, you really can vote with your dollars. And in voting for your dollars, you can get the biggest bang for your buck nutritionally. You can eat less of it, but you can make the greatest impression. And probably one of the most important things you can do is to eat bivalves, which are mussels and clams and oysters and scallops, because they can filter as much as 52 gallons of water a day. So when you look at a bay that may have higher acidification, may have rising temperatures, pH levels lowering, bivalve farms are significantly important, and things like seaweed. The rearing of more domestic seaweed could eclipse the corn crop by 2040 in the United States and is much more regenerative. So it's really looking at, you know, what's on your plate in order to be able to make the greatest impact from a climate perspective as possible.
When you say it could eclipse the corn crop, you mean in terms of volume?
Volume.
No. You've touched on this a little bit, but let's talk about the ocean in particular and what effective ocean protection looks like, because that's part of the equation. Like you mentioned, it's not the only thing we're thinking about. You know, we want to protect the whales, but it doesn't mean don't use the ocean or its resources. So what does effective ocean protection look like, especially as it relates to our blue food?
Marine protected areas. there is a goal to have protected 30% of our ocean by 2030. And yet, when you look at the SDG goals, the Sustainable Development Goals of the UN, 14 of the SDG goals is the lowest funded, which is under the ocean. We have to be investing in these waters. We have to look at things like carbon credits, blue carbon credits specifically, so that we're replanting seagrasses and we're actually protecting coral. A marine protected area provides, it's not like fish has passports. You know, the ocean is still this big wild frontier, but when you protect it, what you do is you protect spawning grounds. When you look at coral, you think of all of the species that actually use the coral as a thriving ecosystem. So when we protect these areas, we actually will rebuild and rebound fisheries. So there's a marine protected area off of the coast of Hawaii. It's the largest marine protected area in the world. It was established by President Bush Jr., and then it was expanded by Obama. Just recently, the current administration has said that they want to open that up to fishing again. But when we look at the science, while sport fishermen and fishermen will really from the outset sometimes fight these marine protected areas, what was amazing about this one in particular was that tuna, like yellowfin tuna that we have such a consumptive entitlement for and cannot farm it. Tuna's one where we have not been able to figure out how to rear a tuna because of the natural ecosystem that it has to be in. But when you look at how it rebounded, they migrated to the MPA. They had a place where they could spawn and grow. And when they left, it rebounded the fisheries. In some cases, that fishery, not only is it prolific, but it's 3 to 4 times more prolific than in King Kamehameha's time. So, and this is happening in small examples all over the world. It's one of the things we actually talked about in our series, Hope in the Water. We talked about a marine protected area. In the Isle of Arran, there were two men that fought for over 13 years to fight 1 square mile of their bay. When they did, that scallop fishery, because it was decimated by scallop dredging, actually has completely rebounded and is delivering to those communities a significant more amounts of fish and seafood. So MPAs, very important. You know, you really can use your voice to be supporting things like the Magnuson-Stevenson Act, which is one of the most important pieces of legislation that was passed in the early 70s to make sure that in the United States, we were fishing to proper levels, supporting funding for NOAA to make sure that there is proper monitoring of our fisheries, because it is very difficult.
The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, or MSA, passed in 1976, marked a pivotal moment in U.S. fisheries management, creating a 200-mile exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, that placed the nation's fishery resources under federal control for the first time. This landmark legislation was designed to tackle the twin crises of overfishing and dwindling marine biodiversity with the goal of preserving fish stocks for future generations. Since its enactment, the MSA has successfully overseen the recovery of once-depleted species like the Atlantic cod, though challenges remain, particularly with bycatch and climate change. Notably, the MSA has set ambitious targets like rebuilding overfished populations within 10 years, but over 30% of U.S. fish stocks are still considered overfished or subject to overfishing. With regional fishery management councils at the helm, the Act has been instrumental in shifting from a catch-as-much-as-you-can mindset to one that values sustainability and ecosystem health. Yet, as pressures on marine environments grow, the Act's ability to adapt to new challenges, such as ocean acidification, is more crucial than ever.
Again, fish migrate, they move around. It's difficult to understand, but we have to have cooperation at all levels, from the local level all the way up to the federal level. And knowing we import more fish and seafood in the United States than we actually produce ourselves. So understanding if you're getting mahi-mahi from Ecuador, the odds are it's unsustainable, and we're robbing that community of fish that they need in order to feed themselves. So being aware of where something comes from, because it's such a global market, fish and seafood changes hands more than any other food or beverage product in the entire supply chain. On average, 8 to 9 times. And there's more slavery in the fish and seafood supply chain because the deep ocean is highly unregulated.
Wild fishing is deeply intertwined with modern-day slavery, a grim reality that impacts millions of people worldwide. It's estimated that over 1 million people are trapped in forced labor in the global fishing industry, with many working on fishing boats under horrific conditions. In some regions, human traffickers lure vulnerable individuals from impoverished communities with promises of work, only to subject them to extreme exploitation. Workers endure grueling hours, sometimes up to 20 hours a day, with little food, no pay, and constant threats of violence. These fishermen are often trapped on boats for years, unable to escape due to the remote locations and lack of regulation in international waters. The demand for cheap seafood, driven by supermarkets, and the global appetite for fish fuels this dark side of the industry, with forced labor becoming a hidden yet essential part of the supply chain. Even more troubling, illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, or IUU, is directly linked to human trafficking. With some estimates suggesting that IUU fishing accounts for up to 30% of global fish catch, it's nearly impossible to trace the origin of seafood and to hold perpetrators accountable.
So it's really important to be actively involved, be aware. And even if it's only just, if you're not up for eating dogfish, that's okay. But know where your salmon comes from. Support the farmers you love, and maybe look at the wild as a special occasion, because that's a resource where we have to balance now with more farmed seafood done the right way versus wild, because the wild ocean cannot continue to sustain this level of fishing.
So when we're talking about all of this fish coming out of the ocean, we're talking about feeding people, right? Like you talked about, the 3 billion people that are being sustained and nourished by blue food that's coming out of all of our waters. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on this in terms of equitable human prosperity.
Well, there are a couple of things. The majority of the fish that's taken out of the sea at this point is taken out for unsustainable aquaculture. So the anchovies, the sardines, the herring, all of those little feeder fish that eat the krills and the algae that then bring us up the food chain then to those carnivorous fish that bring us the EPA, DHA, long chain omega-3s are actually being scooped out of the ocean at a high rate to go into the feed that you see in, for example, unsustainable salmon farming. So we have to really be pushing the farmers to have better, it sounds familiar as on land, right? But we have to be making sure that they're changing feed models and that they're building programs that are algae-based instead of fish oil-based in order to have a really nutritive diet for those fish, but without robbing the ocean of resources that are lower on the food chain. You don't want to take krill pills. You should know where your fish oil pills are from. Krill is exceedingly important. It is the starting point of the entire ocean ecosystem. And we should not be harvesting wild krill to be able to take in a pill ourselves. And that's something that's coming like a freight train. They use krill in some unsustainable aquaculture as well. Whole Foods is likely to come out with a feed model certification that's going to say no krill. We can farm algae on land, and we can put it in things like your toothpaste, just like we can for your ice cream as a thickener and gelatins, but also to be able to have as a sustainable supplement for all of us in health and wellness and longevity. In answer to your question, when we look at human welfare, the good news now in those certifications and recommendations is that just like we're looking at this with fair trade, fair trade in the United States is a small program in their fishery and aquaculture program. But ultimately, the hope is that it will be like coffee and chocolate, and where there'll be a environmental tick and expectation, there will also be a human welfare tick. And ASC and MSC have those as well. So there's a lot of hard work that's going on to make sure that the supply chain is slavery free, to make sure that there's equitable welfare for workers. And that, you know, what you really want is to be supporting, when it comes to wild capture, small scale fisheries, so that you know that if it's a two-person boat and then they're hook and line catching the fish, that's a smaller supply chain that you would be able to trace, hopefully.
With 71% of the Earth's surface covered in water, one kind or another, and we are also, at least as a public, somewhat familiar with the threats of overfishing, of pollution, of habitat loss, and you've touched on all of these, as well as climate change. How big is the crisis right now? Where are we on the meter in terms of the crisis level?
I think it's such a fascinating thing. There's so much of our ocean that we have not explored. I think we're only touching the surface in terms of what we know and understand about how connected planetary health is with our ocean. From a carbon sequestration perspective, certainly, we're starting to understand what that looks like and how delicate that balance is. I mean, kelp forests globally sequester much, much more carbon, for example, than the land-based tree forest that you hear about. So our ocean forest, for example. But with loss of predators, with changing ocean environment, you look at things like purple urchin that are eating up the kelp forest. When things are out of balance, that's when we end up in crisis. And the ocean has really reached a tipping point in terms of that, because you can see it with ocean warming. The Gulf of Maine is the fastest warming body of water on the planet. You look at what's happening with the Mediterranean. These are things that are exceedingly difficult to resolve. Marine protected areas will help. But a lot of this has to just do with our consumption. I mean, last week was the day in the year where we hit what was our now negative impact, right? What the planet provides us. And now we're in a deficit as we consume to the end of the year. And each year that gets earlier and earlier and earlier. And the ocean is at the front lines of all of that. We talk about this in Hope in the Water. You can watch it on PBS. You know, one of the things was we wanted this information out and available so that people could understand what they could do about it. We are at a crisis point because there are things like deep sea mining that are being considered. Deep sea mining will not only hurt and affect these very delicate balances on the deep ocean floor. So things like releasing these microorganisms that the rest of the food column relies on. We don't do a lot of deep sea mining at this point. There's been some exploration with it. There's been some equipment development. But right now, we're at a point where we can make a decision to be against deep sea mining. And that could provide a lot of support for us.
Deep sea mining threatens to upend the fragile ecosystems of the ocean floor, which remain some of the least understood and most delicate habitats on Earth. Located thousands of meters below the surface, these ecosystems host unique species that have adapted to extreme conditions, such as crushing pressures and near-freezing temperatures. In fact, more than 90% of marine species are still undiscovered, many of which live in these deep sea environments. The mining process disturbs the seabed, releasing toxic metals like mercury and lead into the water, which can travel vast distances, over 1,000 kilometers in some cases, affecting marine life far beyond the extraction site. The sediment plumes created by mining smother delicate coral reefs and filter feeders, disrupting entire food webs. What's more, as the deep sea ocean plays a critical role in regulating the global carbon cycle, absorbing up to 25% of human-made carbon emissions, destroying these ecosystems could exacerbate climate change with potentially irreversible effects on both local biodiversity and the planet's overall health. With up to 5 million square kilometers of the deep sea potentially exposed to mining activities, the stakes are higher than ever.
part of looking at things like these rare minerals that are in things like rechargeable batteries, your car battery, you could make more of an impact by eating responsible seafood than buying an electric car. And those rare minerals like lithium should not be coming from those nodules that have been on the ocean floor for millennia. We do have decisions and choices that we can make. Supporting more seaweed, supporting MPAs, supporting regenerative aquaculture, doing education programs with coastal landowners, you know, our working waterfronts are changing. The only people that can afford it are and are building big houses along those working waterfronts are great big houses where they can afford for those houses to go down in some type of climate event like a big storm. They don't care if there's insurance or not, but they don't understand how important it is to have an oyster farm right on the water in front of them. There is a NIMBYism that's happening, and probably the greatest threat to aquaculture in the United States are the oyster farmers not being able to get renewals for their licenses because of the ability of a wealthy person to fight a very false narrative in court about what exists. Look at these as a way to keep your bay clean. Look at it as a way to keep that waterway beautiful. And maybe you work with the oyster farmer so you get to serve oysters at all your parties and you're supporting them staying in state waters where they have a right to be. So I think it's a long way of saying there is a lot happening that's a problem, just as there is in so many places in the world. But when you get involved in this blue food system, when you support it in this way, we can make dynamic changes. And really, it can change even just with the way in which you use your fork. I always say you can change the ocean by the way you snack, because if we all just started having seaweed snacks in the afternoon or a seaweed chip that tastes very similar to a potato chip, you could make a massive difference and a market change that can create real change on the water.
Tell me a little bit about Fed by Blue. And I'd also like to hear about your background and how you got here. Obviously, there's a passion there, but there's more.
Well, and it takes a village. I've been very lucky to be surrounded by incredible people that have been building momentum around this and really figuring out how to build this complicated puzzle that is would be marine protected areas and responsible aquaculture and responsibly managed fisheries all working together. Fed by Blue, our goal was Fed by Blue Foods, which we've established are not blueberries. Our mission is to communicate the importance of responsibly sourced foods from water. Now, that may seem like, well, that's easy, Jen. I already know that if I eat the recommended weekly allowances of salmon, I'm going to be better and I should know where my food comes from. But the narrative of foods from water has really been left off the table when we look at our future of food discussions and conversations. I was in one with a very prominent state with a governor that is exceedingly important, one of the largest economies in the world, and they were building a climate change resilient food plan and policy, and there were no blue foods on the table, and a coastally based state. And so when I look at this and I think, why is that? You know, when I'm in conversations, in large scale food conversations, if the FAO is saying from the UN that aquaculture is the most important protein source that we will have on the planet by 2050 when we reach 10 billion, but you don't know it, where is the miss in the communication? How do you build that trust? How do you socialize trust in order to create momentum and change? So that's really what Fed by Blue is doing, not in a way that starts with government, but in a way that really starts with you. So I would say that is the first thing. And then we're doing that through several areas of impact. We have a education program, grades 6 through 12. We're looking at STEM and career education. Our learning media toolkits, which we launched when the docuseries launched with PBS, went into 90% of schools in the United States, over 440,000 downloads. And if you look them up, PBS Learning Media, comma, hope in the water, Google search it. There are 5 bespoke learning media toolkits that teachers and students can use in under 10 minutes and integrate it into their STEM education. So that was a big one for us. And working with other organizations like Grades of Green and Yellow Farmhouse, which is in Connecticut, where we took teachers out on a boat to harvest kelp, and then we brought it all the way back to the classroom for them to cook with it and learn about it. We also have a restaurant and retailer education program. So the idea that you could walk in the store, you could see some type of content from the docuseries for PBS, but then you'd be like, oh, Martha Stewart was on a scallop farm. That was really cool. Now I can buy scallops and know what that means for the environment. And if you want to learn more, you can watch the docuseries. And then our media efforts, which we believe are the way that our other programs kind of can ride the coattail into more mainstream conversations. So Hope in the Water, the docuseries, it's available now on PBS and Amazon. Over 8 million people have watched it. It's been one of the most successful multi-platform launches of a documentary or docuseries in PBS history. By the way, become a PBS member. That's the most important thing you can do right now to fight the defunding issue of PBS. Become a member of your local PBS station. And then we have a cookbook coming out with HarperCollins Harvest. It's a definitive guide to blue foods. It's being written by Andrew Zimmerman and a renowned seafood expert, Barton Seaver. We've got the podcast, which you know about, Fed by Blue, which continues those stories. And we're agnostically funded, science-based through a group called Blue Food Assessment that sits at Stanford. So we're really saying, look, it's quantifiable. It's science-based, it's important to understand, and we're really hoping that people begin to understand what they can do about it through this important food resource, both here and globally.
An incredible effort. And your background?
So I started out actually just a passionate foodie. My grandparents were third generation cattle ranchers in rural Colorado. They had trout creeks on their property, and they had their own general store. And so I came from knowing and understanding where, you know, farming people, understanding where my food came from. And one day in the midst of my career, I had written cookbooks. I had a cooking school. My syndicated pieces were nominated for a James Beard Award, nominated for the International Association of Culinary Professionals Awards and Teaching Cooking Teacher of the Year. And I got a call saying, we're going to bring the most sustainably raised fish to market. And we think that you should be one of the people that will help us do it. And it was like this for me. I didn't understand why we had a consumptive entitlement to ocean and wild stocks when we farmed everything else. It felt very similar to what my grandfather had done. And everything built from there. So working with farmers, working with fishermen and fisheries, doing consulting. And then this was a natural founding. Fed by Blue with my 2 co-founders was a natural pivot to see if we could really change the narrative.
Sounds incredibly rewarding work for you. And it kind of connects you all the way back into your personal history.
Definitely. And I feel like it resonates with people when they really learn and understand what the potential can be. There's so much bad in the world. And we have an incredible group of people that produce the docuseries. Andrew Zimmerman, of course, as I've mentioned, but David E. Kelly, who's a renowned producer and writer in Hollywood. For those of the listeners that don't know, I mean, L.A. Law, Ally McBeal, The Undoing, but he's also an avid fly fisherman. And he and his wife, Michelle Pfeiffer, are the largest trout producers in the United States. They have an incredible responsible farm in Idaho called Riverence Trout, steelhead and rainbow trout. And their feeling is the answer to declining stocks of salmon is responsible aquaculture and trout. So 86% of the time when you have trout on a menu or out of a grocery store, it's David's trout. And so we all worked together to tell the most character-driven stories we could. He believes this. If you watch Big Little Lies or The Undoing, like character-driven stories where those characters and the dynamics and the emotion that they have, that they're bringing that to bear on camera. And when you sort of layer that with the hope of what they're working on, that's really how we truly change hearts and minds. And then the last thing is wrap it like a warm blanket with the impact campaigns that we do. So you don't just watch, because documentaries and docuseries do not change behavior. We've spent millions and millions of dollars in Hollywood on unscripted series trying to get people to change. It doesn't work. But when you are in schools and you're showing pieces of the series and you're putting that with a place to buy the seafood or a reason, an interesting and compelling reason to support it, that's when you can change consumptive behavior. And our advisory board and our agnostic funders who support things like ocean causes have all said the only reason for doing the content is if you can shift behavior. And that's what we're endeavoring to do. We're really only at the beginning of it. But again, you can protect the ocean, you can protect waters and produce from them. And we need to get in front of that, given the type of food crisis with the population that we're going to be facing.
If today's conversation changed the way you think about seafood or about where the future of our food might come from, I hope it also inspires you to act. Ask questions at the seafood counter. Try something new like oysters or kelp that supports ocean health. And remember, what's on your plate has the power to protect our waters and feed our world. If you enjoyed this episode of One Bite is Everything, please follow or subscribe wherever you listen, and take a moment to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people like you discover these important stories. Special thanks to my guest, Jennifer Bushman, for sharing her passion and expertise. Check the show notes for some important links. Also, special thanks to Sonia Dillon for co-production and to Russell Chepa for sound design, engineering, and original music. This is One Bite is Everything. Until next time, I am your host, Dana DePrima, reminding you that every bite connects you to the rest of the world. Let's make every bite count.